Good afternoon and welcome to Marketing Sherpa's annual teleconference on business technology marketing practical benchmark data. This year, of course, is 2006. I am thrilled to be here on our third annual teleconference on this topic. I'm Ann Holland. I'm the president of Marketing Sherpa. And with me today is Stefan Tornquist, who is our research director. Now, he led the team that actually did the research for this benchmark guide and all of our benchmark guides. Welcome, Stefan.
Hi, Ann.
Now, everyone who is listening in today, you should have received in the same email where you got the phone number, you should have received a hot link to download a PowerPoint presentation. It's actually a PDF, but it's our PowerPoint slides in the PDF. If you don't have that, just grab that link, dig it out of your email, and print out those slides or look at them on your screen, because we're going to be talking to the charts in that presentation. If you lost the email or you can't find it, no problem. Just zap a quick email over to service@marketingsherpa.com. Our service people, Ron and Sharon, are literally sitting here right now holding copies of the presentation, waiting to email it out to you. Usually about three or four people don't have it, so they're ready to get it to you. Yes, you can download this, you can print it out, and you can share this presentation with your colleagues. So hopefully everyone can enjoy these fabulous slides. Now, one of the reasons, and if you've got your presentation, please turn to page two. One of the reasons why I am so happy and grateful to be able to be handing out these wonderful data charts is because so many of you helped out this year to make this guide the best one ever. In fact, Stefan, you had 1,900 business technology marketers came and helped out and gave you data.
That's exactly right. It's unusual to get such a round number, but that's how it shook out.
I was like, that's not a real number, but it was the real number.
That's right.
Okay. So as you see, not only did 1,900 business technology marketers, they came online, they answered different parts of our survey. Also, a lot of you very graciously allowed our research team to contact you via telephone. We only talked to people who proactively asked that we talk to them and agreed to it. And we asked more questions there and were able to really dive down into what's working in business technology marketing. And then we also did an observational study where Stefan's team went out and actually looked at, in particular, software marketers' websites. Now, when we talk about business technology, I want to be really clear. This is a study for everyone who is a business-to-business marketer in anything that's a technology-related field. You could be marketing, email broadcast ASP services. You could be marketing PCs. You could be marketing high-end enterprise software. You could be marketing servers, all sorts of different things like that. You could be marketing consulting services that relate to that. I mean, IT consulting services are a huge marketplace these days. So that's all the different things that you could be in. It's a fairly broad field. What's interesting, of course, about it, though, is that a lot of you have the same prospects that you're targeting. In addition, Stefan, it looks like we had two partnered studies, one of them in particular, the CNET partnered study, where we actually surveyed people who were on CNET's business-to-business sites, such as ZDNet, and asked them what they thought about marketing, email newsletters, and blogs. In addition, we gathered best-of secondary research from almost a dozen other research organizations who also studied this field. Some of it was exclusive just to Marketing Sherpa. So you have all this enormous amount of information we tried to compile in one place. Now let's move on. Let's go to the fun stuff, the charts. If you'll turn with me to page three of the presentation. Okay, Stefan, this is the first chart. It is marketing spend of business-to-business technology marketers. Can you explain what this number is extremely clearly to me? Because it looks like a very small number.
Well, this is the number that a lot of businesses use as a measure, and it's the percentage of gross revenue. So it's a hard business number, and the percentage of 3.6 that's very close to what a number of organizations identify across the industry as an average. But as we can see, that doesn't really reflect the range of what's happening. At the low end of the normal range, actually less than 1% of gross revenues, you typically find manufacturers in niche markets, those that don't really see a lot of need for, any sort of brand marketing, and typically tend to spend a lot more on their sales force because they've identified, very often they have fewer than 1,000 prospects nationwide, and so they're able to target those folks with salespeople directly. They do tend to maintain email programs and such, and typically focus on events for those prospects. Then as we move up the range, we get to other kinds of companies, service industries, ASPs, those companies that are sort of newer to the space also tend to have higher percentages. Now, of course, there are outliers here. There are companies spending more than 10% of gross revenues in marketing. Those definitely tend towards companies that haven't been around for more than 10 years, companies that are looking to establish name and go for share. They also, you know, for companies that haven't been around very long, and certainly for those companies that are venture-backed, gross revenues doesn't mean so much because they don't have any. So in cases like that, the percentages are based on total money in the bank, really.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm assuming this does not, of course, include any sales compensation or sales force costs. It really is strictly marketing.
That's correct.
And I'm also assuming it doesn't include salary for the marketing department?
Oh, no, it would include any internal salaries and vendor fees.
Wow, so it seems very low to me. Is it because mainly business technology is so heavily driven by the sales department?
Well, in part, but also gross revenues are the big number that folks are dealing with. So.
Exactly, that's a very big number. Why don't we move on? Now, this next chart on page 4, this is the one that a lot of people wonder about because they want to know how to break up their budget. What is the normal breakout, offline versus online? You know, I talk to so many marketers in business technology, and often they'll tell me how they've really been changing their budget. They're leaving the trade publications. They're leaving print. They're leaving some of the classic, you know, snail mail things they used to do, although direct mail is certainly working for some. And they're telling me that they're spending a lot more online. I think I'd expected to see a very high percent of marketing budget spent online. Was this surprising to you, Stefan, having looked at those numbers for 3 years?
Well, I think if you look at the average itself, it's not so surprising. This is one of those cases where the straight average of 31% really doesn't tell the story at all. Large organizations, Fortune 500, Fortune 1000 organizations, they're spending generally less than 10% of their budgets online, even in technology. Those are companies with brand presence, even on television. When industry-wide figures about online marketing go out and you see, 9% is being spent online, these are the kinds of companies that folks are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But when you start going...
These gargantuan road shows and all sorts of other fancy-schmancies that they're paying for.
Right. Online is relatively inexpensive in comparison with some of those tactics,
mm-hmm.
certainly television and print being far more expensive. So
mm-hmm.
as you move up down the chain of company size, you see the percentage rising very steadily. I mean, they're, of course, solo practitioners who, in our study, tended to either be consultants or small software designers who are, they have one or two products that
mm-hmm.
that they've developed. And for those folks, online represents the majority of their spending. And typically, with those folks, it tends to be with search, but there is some variation there. It's the small and medium organizations who are spending probably what you would have expected the numbers to be, between 25 and 37%.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Okay, so really what matters more is how big you are and perhaps less what industry you're in. You know, you had mentioned, because initially we were planning to slice all this data very specifically by industry. Are you in software? Are you in hardware? Are you, in services? And, Stefan, you had mentioned to me that many of the numbers didn't seem to vary as much depending on that. When they do, you mentioned it, but it didn't vary as much depending on that as it did either the size of the organization that was marketing, how big this company was, the marketer's company was, or the size of the company they were targeting. That seemed to make a big difference, too.
Yes, that's right. I mean, in part, the budget number is one of the hardest ones to identify in a survey format. So the more you slice it down, the less exact it gets. That's one of the reasons that we went in this direction, because we were able to have a nice solid set of data. When you start slicing that by 9 different verticals, you start getting a little bit of variation that you don't want. But yes, it's absolutely true that it's the size of the organization itself rather than – sorry, I hope you can't hear the thunderstorm taking place here in New York. rather than the size of target organization that seems to differentiate between or to determine the percentage of online spend.
Okay. Why don't we move on to page 5? Now, this is one of, I think, the sexiest charts in this entire presentation because really what it talks about is the prospect, you know, which marketing moves the dial. In this case, it's what actually influences these decision makers. Now, Stefan, correct me if I'm wrong, these are the 633 surveyed business decision makers who we asked what made a difference when they were making decisions about buying technology.
Right, and specifically, we asked the question, think about a purchase you have made, not what do you read every day, not what tactics do you notice, but we asked them to identify a specific decision that they had, a purchase decision they had been a part of in the last year, and to credit those marketing tactics that played a role. So, of course, the numbers add up to much more than 100% because, as we know, a technology buying process is a long one and many different factors come to bear. But I liked that question, and I think it's one we'll continue to ask by having people latch on to a specific purchase. It sort of focuses them. So as we look down this fairly long list, what are the surprises? I think the emerging tactics did fairly well. You know, some people might look at this and say, well, you know, all of these, you know, blogs from vendors and podcasts, these are very small numbers. But I think that for emerging tactics, and that's certainly what podcasts are, blogs are up there at 10%, so that's a strong response. But even those down under 5%, I think for this group in particular to be able to look back and think, you know, I listened to a podcast that was part of this process is really a validation.
Mm-hmm.
One number here that I'm a little suspect of, to be honest, is the 2.8% that said a cold call telephone inquiry played a role. I suspect that number is higher.
Nobody wants to admit it.
Nobody wants to admit it, even to themselves.
Because they don't want to encourage it.
And over the course of, you know, we'll take a look at what sales cycles are doing, and many companies take a year to buy something, even longer potentially. Mm-hmm. I think in the course of that, you may forget that your first introduction to a salesperson was a cold call and maybe credit that to an existing relationship. It's a little bit like spam. When you ask people whether they ever click on spam, of course they say no, and yet we know that sometimes people do.
Yeah. A couple of things that are interesting here, which is that aside from word of mouth, the top two things are offline. You know, you've got 41% at conferences and trade shows and 40% at, paying attention to print magazines, that they really do pay attention to print magazines. And I think that's very interesting.
They absolutely do. You know, the offline tactics, you know, with all of the interest in online, it does get lost as budgets are moving around. You know, the talk is about the budget moving, not necessarily around the fact that the big numbers are still offline and will continue to be for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But online tactics, you know, the magazines, email newsletters, natural listings, those come in a strong second. And when you consider the relative costs, if we had an ROI figure up and down this list, we would see probably the best ROI figures in those online tactics.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I also think is interesting, just given that, it tells you that your PR budget should be fairly substantial still. It's not just placing ads in magazines and online magazine websites. I mean, although, of course, that works, and we've got plenty of data in the guide about that, but it has to do with PR, and in particular the PR, you better have, if you don't already, in-house a calendar of every possible award or review that your product could ever be up for. There are a zillion of them. I think it's something like more than 400 in business technology that you can be up for. Yes, you can go for the SIA Big Annual Awards, but there's a heck of a lot more. Almost every magazine has, of course, regular reviews in their calendar of different types of things, and they often have readers' picks, editors' picks, all sorts of awards. And I would be managing an awards calendar very heavily if I were you. That's the kind of content that tends to not only be something that you can brag about later, and your sales reps love it, but it also gets you that mention in a really good spot in the print magazine and the online magazine. The other thing I think is very interesting is that the blogs from other technology professionals was at 19% compared to blogs from industry analysts and media. and also that word of mouth is so high. It seems like business technology buyers are, let's just say, they don't completely trust the experts, the people who were the so-called experts who, let's face it, 10 years ago, the only people really you could learn about technology were the magazines and the analysts and the experts. Now you can go online and find a wealth of other people kind of sounding off about your product. That tells me you need to be watching the blog sphere very carefully. You need to be tracking it. You also need to be tracking different types of forums where different technology people and business executives are posting opinions about your technology. Anything from email discussion groups to online forums. There are so many of them, and you need to probably have someone on your staff who is routinely checking them. There are pretty cheap software programs that can check a lot of this stuff for you, too. You need to be looking out. Where are people saying, oh, you know, who does who recommend? So if they're not getting it from word of mouth from people, if they are going online and surfing other bloggers, other people in their industry, you know what they're hearing about you. Last but not least, I hope with word of mouth that you're talking internally about what can you do this fall, perhaps, or add to your budget for next year that would encourage positive word of mouth among your clients to prospects. I'm not talking about bribing people, though. I'm not talking about, oh, gee, you know, we'll give you, you know, an iPod every time you tell somebody something great about us. There are other types of loyalty and evangelism campaigns that are out there. We certainly track them, and there are other evangelist trackers as well. We're adding a new part to our website that will include case studies and evangelism. There are all different ways that you can add a little evangelism to your mix, and it has a significant impact, as you can see here. I think a lot of marketers are so focused on getting that email campaign out and getting that white paper posted and, you know, getting the next webinar done that they forget about client evangelism, which is so critical. I think the extent of a lot of client evangelism efforts are, gee, we hope people will forward our email newsletter. And I think there's I know that there's a lot more you can do beyond that. Anyway, let's move on. And this next chart on page 6, we put this chart in here specifically because trade shows are still such a huge part of the influencer cycle. This is obviously it's a significant part of your budget, and it's certainly hugely influential still. I wanted to know which trade shows are the most influential ones. If you're going to spend your money, where do you spend it? I know that when I myself was a business-to-business marketer, we would often make trade show decisions, especially in the beginning, based on what the management of the company told us to do. You know, the CEO would say, I want to be here. And it was kind of the same decisions that they would say if they talked to the PR firm, they'd say, I want to be on the cover of the Wall Street Journal. Well, you know, that's all very well and fine, but A, it could be awfully expensive because you really do have to work hard to get that. But B, does it really hit the influencers who are specifically going to buy your thing? Well, guess what? Here you can see, just as with PR, the vertical seems to be much more powerful. Stefan, can you talk us through this chart?
Sure. And one thing I should explain about this chart is that we're comparing these numbers. If you look at, say, total leads for a general show over on the left-hand side, coming in at 83, that 83 is per 1,000 attendees. So that's the measure. Now, of course, a lot of shows are far smaller than that, and that's going to vary the response. But the reason we repeated this question this year was we didn't really expect it to change much, and it didn't. But it's still an important lesson, and sometimes if data gets more than a year old, people don't pay as much attention. So even though it doesn't vary much, we'll probably continue with this one. It's an elementary lesson, but one that's worth repeating, that the qualified leads, the ratio of qualified leads is about 50% higher out of those vertical shows. Now, of course, there are different benefits to the larger shows, there's a significant element of brand in attending. But those qualified lead numbers do suggest that those small targeted shows do ultimately pay off, and they do tend to be cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing about trade show marketing in general, and this is, I think, almost universally true outside of the Fortune 1000, is that it's the hardest for marketers to really keep track of, depending on how many folks they're bringing to a trade show, how many of those salespeople are having their own conversations, collecting their own cards. It can be very difficult at the end of it all to really get a firm grasp on how many leads were generated.
Mm-hmm.
we heard a few tricks on keeping those things together. I spoke with one marketer who has threatened her sales team with keeping their commission back if they hold a card back from a show. If eventually she finds out that a card originated at say AdTech and was never credited. However, she admits privately that that's not a very easy thing to do.
No. The nice thing about these numbers is it also helps you if you've got an executive on your team who is dying to give speeches, and almost everybody does have someone who's sort of a wannabe diva. You know what? This is a great way to convince them they should try out a few vertical shows, and that's a great way to break them in anyway. They need some breaking in to learn how to handle the crowd and learn how to handle giving an effective speech and all of that. And, you know, tell them, hey, great, you know, I'm going to get you some speaking gigs at vertical niche shows. They're easier actually often to get a speech at anyway and to get a speech anyone's going to pay attention to. And then, you know, great, we're going to probably end up getting better leads from it and doing fairly well. So it's a good motivator to pop somebody onto a plane and get them into some vertical shows or some luncheons or something like that.
And one other thing I wanted to throw in, and it's sort of related to your press, the importance of press that you made earlier. One of the things that I hear about consistently, and I guess it's because of the folks that I'm talking to, but is the success of doing internal research projects and turning those into public relations opportunities. I mean, I've got a skewed view because these are the folks I'm talking to all the time. But in terms of getting show speaking gigs and getting press, there's nothing like a little piece of research in your niche to generate that that notice.
Oh, yeah, if you can dangle
plus,
research
it'll provide
in front of
data
your organizer.
For me.
Yeah, that's fabulous. By the way, for anyone who joined us after I made this announcement, we are looking at a presentation that was included as a hot link in the welcome email that we sent you. This hot link is a PDF of a PowerPoint presentation. It is the same hot link. It is a hot link in the same email that had the phone number that you're calling right now. If you don't have access to that email and you did not download your presentation, please email over to service@marketingsherpa.com, and they will flip you a copy of that super quick. Yes, you can download it. Yes, you can print it out. And yes, you can share it with your colleagues. Okay, why don't we turn to page number 7 of our presentation? And actually, the title of this page makes me laugh because it's got the word classic. I mean, the word classic in online advertising, I never thought I'd see those words together in a phrase, but now online advertising is 10 years old, and in fact, I think I ran my first business-to-business banner ad 10 years ago, so here we go. It's 10 years old, and now we have classic business-to-business online advertising tactics. Now, these tactics, Stefan, you actually broke these out not only by tactic, but then by the type of prospect that the marketer was marketing to. Is that the case?
That's exactly right. We looked at what tactics are best when you're targeting large organizations versus medium and small ones.
Okay, so you could be any size organization yourself. It's just who your prospect is.
That's absolutely right.
Okay, so what we see here are some really big differences depending on prospect, which of course makes perfect sense because it's prospects who are really different. Can you explain some of the biggest changes?
Sure. Well, I think perhaps the most interesting to me is how marketers perceive the effectiveness of online ads, whether those are in general business sites or industry-specific sites. For marketers that target large companies, they overwhelmingly feel that those general business ads are very effective because perhaps they connote a certain level of brand awareness, a certain stature in the community that large companies are comfortable with. You know, you sort of need to be known in the game to be a prospective vendor to those large companies. Mm-hmm. As you get down to the those who are marketing to small organizations, they find those tactics much less successful, in part because of the high price that one needs to pay to get on those general business sites, you know, a Forbes.com, et cetera. Now, when you look at industry-specific sites, overall, the ratings are pretty high across the board, but you see that organizations targeting medium-sized orgs feel like that's really a great, very effective tactic. Nearly 80% consider it very effective.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that I think is interesting is the white paper syndication service is so incredibly effective. First of all, it's so incredibly effective. And I'll talk to marketers even as recently as yesterday who I'll ask them, so, you know, how is it going syndicating your white paper? And they'll say, what do you mean? What is that again? So it may not be as universally used by every marketer who could be using it as a tactic. I think one of the reasons why white paper syndication works so well is that your white paper is there when the prospect is ready to go trolling for it. And I know that we've had quite a bit of data around the kind of prospects that tend to troll for white papers who tend to be heavy influencers of business technology buying decisions. And they tend to be people who are sometimes a little bit lower down than you would think in the totem pole in the company. Often it's someone who has been delegated to by the committee or by the management team, hey, go out and figure out who we should send the RFP to. And they're actually the one often making the you know, three different companies we're going to send the RFP to decision. Or they're the one who's the strong recommender or the strong enthusiast behind this buying decision. They then get the white paper and often will then shoot it upline. White papers have a strong capability of going slightly viral. So they'll shoot it upline to their boss, they'll shoot it upline to their colleagues, they'll send it to everybody else on the committee and send it around. The other thing is that we've definitely noticed that people go looking for white papers on third-party sites. So it is worth syndicating your white paper on these other places where they're searching for general information when they make their decision. I think it's a fascinating thing to look into. Now, the offers in third-party newsletters, I think, is fascinating that it works so well for when you're targeting small business. I think part of that may be because sometimes your CPM, your cost of running an ad in an email newsletter, may be lower than other types of marketing. It may also be that, let's face it, small business owners usually are way too busy to sit there trolling around, you know, oh, you know, gee, I wonder which accounting system I should use. They're too busy running their florist store or their chain retailer or whatever it is that they're running. So you definitely have a difference there. I think that this is probably why we're seeing such a sellout rate in some of the technology newsletters that are out there. I'm hearing of business-to-business email newsletters that are published, you know, to carry ads, actually selling on advertising 6 to 9 months ahead of time. I'm hearing about trade association email newsletters selling out all their offerings up to a year ahead of time. I'm hearing about these crazy sellouts. So if you're considering testing email newsletter ads, you need to get in there pretty early these days. Any other comments you have on this slide, Stefan?
I think you've covered it pretty well.
Why don't we move on to the next chart? And this, of course, is to some degree more interesting because it's the new stuff. How effective are the new marketing, online marketing channels for B2B marketing? Now, these are things that are just really mainly have just emerged significantly in B2B in the past 2 years. Some of them have been around for a while, but we've only seen marketers paying significant attention to them for the short term. Now, they include optimization of press releases for Google, Yahoo, and MSN News. So in other words, that's tweaking your press release so that it shows up on those news services with hot links. Co-registration for list building. Now, that means email list building. And we have plenty of articles on co-registration and how it's done and how it works on our website. So if you don't know what that is, definitely go look it up. It is fabulous, and even very low-budget marketers can use it because you can do it as a barter. Obviously, podcasting, viral marketing online. I've seen a lot of viral marketing online coming from B2B in the past 12 months. Corporate blogs as opposed to blogs from individuals. Rich media advertising. Of course, rich media advertising is anything with audio or video. That's the way we're defining it. So if it's got a flash or it's got a movie or it's got sound coming out of it, that's rich media. Contextual advertising, that would be Google AdSense instead of AdWords or other contextual ads. These are ads that show up on content sites often that are just related to the content that's on the page. Often they're text only. Virtual trade shows, which we've done a few case studies on, that's one where you go online. It's sort of like a webinar, only longer. Behavioral ad targeting, That, of course, is where you're placing an advertisement on a website, not based on the content of the website, but based on the content that the person was just looking at. So if somebody was looking at a bunch of reviews for personal computers, and then they go off to a new page on the website and they're looking at personal finance, a computer ad might still pop up based on their past behavior. And last but not least, advertising on blogs. Okay, Stephanie, can you talk us through what the high points of this research are? What were the big surprises for you?
Sure. Well, first let me say, because these are emerging tactics in large part, we don't have the huge data set that we have in regards to, say, search and email. You know, by definition, for them to be emerging, they're not being used by huge numbers of marketers. So that said, we still had plenty of folks to generate some very interesting data. The strength of co-registration was actually a surprise to me. I know that this is an area that you've been a key voice on, but in business to business, you know, we don't see so many companies doing co-registration. I think about in research we did into co-registration, about 15% of those responding to the survey identified themselves as business-to-business marketers. So that was something of a surprise. But of those folks that are using the tactic, they're finding it quite successful. Podcasting, this was really a surprise. Now, again, this is one where usage makes a big difference here. Only about 9% of the folks out there have either created podcasts or sponsored them. But the response is extremely high. Now, podcasting fits very well, in my opinion, with the long sales cycle of many business-to-business technology purchases. But still, it was a surprise.
No, I have a question about that. You said only 9% of the marketers, and I'm assuming business technology marketers,
yes,
out there are using podcasting right now as a tactic. Of those 9%, I seem to remember a lot of variation between the size of the organization they themselves came from. It seemed like very big companies were doing a very different kind of podcasting than little teeny companies.
Well, that's right. I mean, big companies are more likely to be sponsoring someone else's.
Uh-huh.
And outsource the creation and delivery of their podcasts, whereas smaller companies, of course, are doing it in-house. The smaller companies tend to simply use their own channels for distribution. Larger companies are paying to get the word out.
Okay. I think, in a way, if you've got a really cool voice, and, again, that's the kind of person you might speak at a trade show, or it's just the kind of person who would normally write a personal blog about your technology and they just love talking about technology. It's somebody maybe on your staff who tends to contribute really great articles for your email newsletter or gets very vociferous on the topics of white papers. Often organizations have that kind of that content enthusiast. They're extremely passionate about the technology that you do.
That's
and
exactly
often the right person for your podcast. That passion, they're going to hear that in the voice, and I think it's going to change prospects' minds about how much you care about the market. You're not just some marketing organization trying to sell something, and it's not just the sales rep trying to sell something. It's like somebody who really gives a darn.
That's absolutely right. I think the same standard for successful blogs should be applied to podcasts, meaning that those organizations that keep their hands off of the blogs and keep their hands off of the podcasts are likely to be the ones that see the highest upside. You know, there's always a little bit of risk in, you know, not vetting the those communications, but I think from what I'm hearing, the benefits far outweigh the risks there. Those folks that listen to podcasts, folks that read the blogs of other professionals, they can smell a marketing rat in a heartbeat.
Or someone who's a little too pompous. Yeah.
I mean, and it really is all about that voice. And so you're right. If there's someone in the organization that you love to listen to give a presentation, you know, think about canning it and creating a podcast.
Mm-hmm. That's great. You could even take part of your webinar and knock it into pieces. Anyway, one thing that I think is interesting is, of course, the viral marketing online. We're seeing a 26% for very effective. That actually surprised me as being a little high. I have been interviewed recently by, I think, every reporter on this planet. Somehow we got picked up as the source to talk to about viral marketing when we do a lot of studies of it. And they were all asking me what works in viral marketing in B2B. And I am extremely concerned because when I do talk to business-to-business marketers who have been conducting viral marketing campaigns, and believe me, I ask, I'm like, okay, give me the data. What happened? I mean, even if it's off the record, tell me what happened. I need to know. I need to learn what's effective. And so often they haven't measured anything beyond, you know, how many times their little video was viewed, you know, how many people came to the microsite, how many, you know, how cool it was that it got forwarded a lot. You know what? Zillions of views and, you know, zillions of people coming to your microsite or playing your little game or whatever is not necessarily remotely effective marketing. We've been studying viral marketing since 2002 and have discovered that campaigns that were outrageously successful in terms of the number of people who saw them, they quote-unquote went viral, sometimes ended up with this tiny, I mean, low single-digit response rate in terms of the people who actually were decent prospects, who were people who would ever be an influencer or a buyer. You know, instead of appealing to that, you know, sysadmin that you hope to appeal to, you may have a lot of Czechoslovakian teenagers looking at your ad. So there is less control with viral advertising. It has to be extremely pointed, and I really hope that 26% who said it was very effective are not just saying it was effective because they got a bunch of traffic. I hope they're saying it's effective because not only did they track and hopefully generate some leads from that traffic, but then they ranked those leads and they rated them and they said, this is how qualified this lead is, and they tracked those suckers all the way down through the sales cycle, because that's what you have to do. I just, oh, if I never hear another story pitched to me again of somebody saying, we got millions of people through our site, I'm like, oh, I don't care. Tell me about qualified prospects.
Well, Anne, I have a question for you since you're out there talking to these folks all the time. It seems to me that the definition of viral marketing in the B2B world is a lot more vague and perhaps broader than the definition you or I would use.
Yes, probably so.
And I think that may contribute to a higher than expected ranking because, you know, say a contest that gets emailed around.
That might be viral.
That might be viral, but it also might not because it doesn't have the you know, sort of the multimedia aspect or a surprise to it.
Sure. What makes something viral is if it is usually it's a piece of content. It could be an offer, but usually it's a piece of content that could be email, could be a game, could be almost anything, an online form, who knows. But it's something that people are so interested in. They can't help tell some other people about it. They can't help but tell five friends. They can't help but post it on their blog. They can't help but stick it in their email newsletter. They can't help but run around the office going, hey, guys, have you seen this thing? That's what it is. It's that knee-jerk, oh, my God, oh, isn't this? And usually it's very funny or it's very scary or it's very startling. Oh, my God, this news, you know. Or it's something that is, you know, an offer that's insane. I mean, it's just something that they're like, oh, whew, I must send this on. That is very different from classic, what they call word of mouth, which is much more of an evangelism. That's, I really like this technology, and I think that other people on my committee need to learn about this technology, so I'm going to tell them. Or this is a darn good, you know, white paper. I need to forward this to my boss so that we can perhaps buy this thing. That's more of an evangelist thing. It's not, oh, it went crazy viral, and it, you know, crazy viral really is crazy viral. And those are very, very different campaigns. Evangelism tends to be much more qualified. It tends to be much more on the quality of the content, and it tends to be much more related to what you're hoping they're going to do. They're evangelizing your product using your content. Viral often has nothing to do with you at all. It just was, oh, isn't this a hysterical video? Wow, and they're laughing. They don't even know what brand sponsored it. So that's really the difference. By the way, if you go to our homepage and you scroll down under the third column, it's called More Resources, you can see there's a hot link to our Viral Marketing Hall of Fame. And you can see all of this year's winners. And it's open access, and you'll be able to see campaigns about that. In the meantime, why don't we move on to the next slide? Because I think people want to hear the rest of this presentation. And, of course, I'm on page 9, search engine optimization. Stefan, how did we get this data?
Well, this was part of an observational study that we did looking at both large and small to medium-sized, specifically software vendors. Now, this chart looks at the big guys, 60 of the names that we all know. And so, as you would expect, they did pretty well. I guess I'd give them a B-plus, perhaps, on this, or no, let's see, 72% were on the first page. So I guess that would really be a C minus, wouldn't it? The top three natural results saw 44% of those companies represented. The more evidence we see, the more important it is to rank very highly in the natural or algorithmic search, as it's called. The pressure isn't quite as extreme as it is on the paid side, where being in the top paid position makes a huge amount of difference. In business-to-business, people do tend to look a little bit further down the page in those natural results. So we see that between the two, 72% make it onto that first page.
But that's pretty pitiful when you consider these are huge, giant, multi-million software companies.
That's right.
Now, absolutely afford better search engine optimization.
That's absolutely true. Now, the way we did this study was to, for each company we studied, we looked at what they considered to be their primary business area and searched on that. So that's where, you know, certainly all of these companies show up in the top three if you search for some things, their names,
their company
brand
names, yeah,
of products, et cetera. But this is in their key business areas.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, many have a number of different business areas, and they're going to rank differently in those. And, yes, even so, 28% don't make it onto that first page. And even in business-to-business, if you're not on the first page, you're really losing the vast majority of eyeballs.
Yeah, that's pretty pitiful.
And what we don't see here is the data for the smaller companies. And as you might imagine, they don't get quite as well represented in those algorithmic listings. The other point I wanted to make here is that there's quite a bit of research, and we'll be presenting some in our upcoming search guide, but there's quite a lot of research that's going to be available shortly for folks about the combined impact of having paid and natural listings on the same page. What difference does it make to have a top paid and top algorithmic result? The data seems to indicate that there is a strong correlation and higher click-through rate on both as a result of having both of those working in tandem.
Fabulous. So if you've got one, don't abandon the other. Why don't we move to page 10? Now, this is one that I think everybody wants to know. Which lead generation offers on your website are the ones that are the most effective for generating qualified leads? So if you're going to adjust your website, in particular, adjust the standard lead generation offers that are on every page of the site, that should be on every page of the site, what should you really put your effort into? A lot of us maybe don't have the marketing stamina to keep fresh offers for every type of lead gen offer there is out there all the time. So what are you going to put your stamina into? And here, Stefan, you did break out what's most effective by different type of marketers. So you have the services marketers at the top, the software and ASP marketers are the dark bar in the middle, and then the hardware marketers are the bar right below. What I think is fascinating, of course, is in some, obviously, there's a huge difference. I mean, you would expect software marketers to have free trial demos because, you know, they're the kings of free trial demo. So that would make perfect sense. What I think is interesting, though, is for blogs, suddenly you're seeing a really different array. It's in the mid-30s for services and software, but hardware makers, they're not doing well with blogs. Are people who buy hardware not reading the blogs?
You know, I think that this may be a result of hardware makers tend to be some of the larger, more traditional companies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is purely theory, but I wonder if it's the way they're doing their blogging that may be affecting how effective it is. Because at least theoretically, blogging would be one of those tools like podcasting, white papers, et cetera, that would really support the long hardware sales cycle. And yet you don't see it doing as well. I think, you know, that's a case where if you have the right people blogging, if you have truly technical people mm-hmm. blogging about these very technical subjects and doing it
in a genuine manner,
I would expect to see that number be higher, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with podcasts, it's sort of the same thing. And by the way, if you're thinking like, hey, a few charts ago we saw a much higher rating for podcasts, this only looks at those folks who said something was very effective. And, of course, these are for just three of the industries that we were looking at, and mm-hmm. which are, you know, for which we have a great deal of data.
And as always, low-ticket sweepstakes such as T-shirts, PDAs, and iPods, you may get a heck of a lot of responses from them, but they are probably not all that qualified.
Right.
And just so to clarify, I know a lot of people have questions about this. We asked marketers only the marketers who had actually used one of these tactics could reply whether it was effective or not.
Exactly.
So you're not seeing people who had never tried it saying whether it was effective. It was only folks who had already tried it and seen some results. It is nice to see white papers and webinars still up there getting fairly good marks as effective. I mean, in some ways you would think white papers, boy, I'm bored to death of them, but it's just, it's a classic tactic and they really do consistently work.
They absolutely do. I mean, in both of those cases, I think you would see even stronger marks if we were back, you know, a couple of years. There's just a great many more white papers and webinars available than there were, as we all know.
Okay. And let's move on to the next page. This is page 11. And here we see the data, and this is year over year. And it is, I wouldn't say scary, but it's certainly not heartening. Sales cycles are continuing to lengthen and lengthen. It makes the marketing department's job a lot harder because if you're out there spending all your money, you know, generating leads, generating leads, generating leads, you've got a year or more now where what's going on with the nurturing. And my biggest concern, I think, when I ask marketers, I'm like, great, you generated the lead. What's next? You know, really all I hear about from a significant number of marketers, even from bigger companies often, is, oh, well, we do an email newsletter. Well, you know, that's good. That's great. I'm all in favor of the email newsletter, calling as we publish eight of them. So, hey, but what else are you doing? First of all, you've got some of those prospects who just are not email people. You know, there's different types of people. Some people are phone people. Some people are trade show people. Some people are magazine people. Some people are email people. So you've got to have something. You have to be out there in multiple media as a nurturer just to appeal to all your prospects. In addition, of course, with problems with email filters, you can't always count on email getting through. I'm not saying when it gets through, it's effective. However, if you can't count on it getting through, you better have a backup. You better have other messaging going to people because you don't want to leave them sitting there, you know, after having spent all that money on generating that lead, leave them just kind of hanging out. Now, Stefan, in general, you had mentioned that the sales cycle lengthening was slightly different depending on what marketplace people were in.
It does vary somewhat. This is an overall average. The one point I really wanted to make on this slide is that for the past couple of years, we've taken a look at that group that's represented by 12-plus months. So those folks that have seen their sales cycle slide into more than a year. And we can't prove a causal relationship, but we have noticed that those folks have a lower tendency to use tactics beyond the very standard email newsletter. They tend to have lower frequencies of their email newsletters, which in part is probably a reflection of that long cycle, but you also wonder, you know, how many people are falling through the gaps for this group. We tend to see slightly lower uses of you know, different kinds of email testing, et cetera. So I can't prove a chicken and egg relationship here, but for those out there who might see their sales cycle slipping into longer than a year, it might be time to look at what marketing tactics you're using or not using.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now and here we go to the next page. This is page 12. This is, we're back again on data from our CNET study of the 633 business technology buyers who told us all about what affected them in terms of your marketing. And of course, one of the questions we asked them was, what do you do with that email when you're just bored of hearing from this vendor? You're not interested in that newsletter anymore. You are not interested in that sales alert anymore. What happens? What are you doing? Now, we have a significant amount of data from other studies indicating that a tiny number of people actually ever click on that unsubscribe list. So I got to tell you, Stefan, the 44% who say I go through their unsubscribe process, I am so doubting that.
Well, you know, it's one of those cases where you do wonder if the reality matches what people are reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, admittedly, in the case...
I mean, I've never, ever met a marketer who said they had a high unsubscribe rate.
No,
I mean,
of course.
I've never met a marketer who had a high unsubscribe
rate. Nobody has a high unsubscribe rate. Now, it is true that we do see people going through the unsubscribe process to a greater degree for business-to-business sites. you know, they have a reliance that their unsubscribe will actually go through. But I, like you, I do suspect that some of that 44% end up hitting delete or the spam button or doing nothing. And that's, to me, the most interesting part of this slide is that it sort of begins to quantify that percentage of folks who just allow those emails to come in, check out the subject line, maybe scan in the preview pane, and don't really go through any sort of process to end the relationship. So there's still an opportunity there, but how to take advantage of it. Now, I know you've been talking about the preview pane, and that's just becoming more and more important.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you say, I still scan quickly looking for something useful, I mean, when is the last time, if you use, in particular, Outlook, and soon, Yahoo and Hotmail, they're changing the way they do things. But when you use those and you're looking at email that you're not enormously interested in, you're skipping through a heavy inbox pretty quickly, usually you just look at stuff in preview. You're not opening, you know, you're not clicking and, you know, looking at each thing and really carefully opening it and saying, hey, I'm going to scan quickly now. No, you know, you're glancing at it in preview. We've got study data showing more than 60% of business users, I think it's something like 69%, use that preview pane. So that's a huge number of people who are using that preview pane, and you can betcha that your email, if they're not totally involved and engrossed and loving, you know, the stuff they're getting from you, that's what they're doing with your email if they open it at all. They're opening it in preview. And in answer to the big question, everybody always asks this question, you know, can my email program determine which people open it in preview as opposed to which people clicked and opened the email all the way? No, there is absolutely no way on this planet to determine that. Anybody who tells you so, have them call me, because I would love to hear about it. I've never, ever heard of a way, and believe me, I've talked to a lot of techies about this. So you don't know whether they're using the preview panel, except the study data showing that 69% of them are. Therefore, when they're skimming through your newsletter or your white paper offer or whatever, they're doing so in this teeny little box. I mean, I always tell people, think about how worried we are with our website design. You know, you're trying to keep everything above the fold. Well, think about what this means for the email fold, because the email fold, that's much tinier than a main website. That's the email fold. That's dinky. I mean, what is that? That's maybe 4 inches across. Maybe it's 2 inches down. You know, the little boxes are not that big. So they're looking at a tiny little, usually the upper left-hand corner of your email that you sent, and making a decision. And remember, they're not interested anyway. They're just trying to get through their inbox. So you better have something pretty darn exciting in that upper left corner. And when I say exciting, I mean something that is truly of interest to them, truly interesting content, not the iPod offer, but something that really is fascinating for these folks to take a look at in there. Now, why don't we go on? How do you know what is truly exciting? Because you know what? What's truly exciting to you and me as marketers is never what's truly exciting to the prospects, practically. Well, on page 13, you'll see more and more business marketers, and I am thrilled to death to see this number, more and more business marketers are using personas to determine what is truly exciting to their email recipients, to their website surfers, to their direct mail recipients, to their prospects, to their customers. Now, Stefan, can you briefly describe what a persona is?
Absolutely. But before you get too excited, let me point out that this slide looks at the usage of personas by large companies. This is not across the board. Smaller and medium-sized companies use the concept of personas much less, although ironically, it's not an expensive process and can be very useful. So a persona is a theoretical buyer. It is someone that you've defined from their name, how many kids they have, to the kind of executive they are, what part of the country they're in. And what that lets you do is really start thinking about your marketing, your website design, every element of your marketing and sales process through the eyes of the customer. What we've done for this guide is to create a series of personas. One of our research team members comes out of the agency world where personas are very often used. And so we asked her to go through all of the information that Marketing Sherpas got from doing all of these case studies and interviews, and to use those to build, I believe there are 13 profiles and personas in the guide, looking at, you know, how is it that, you know, a CEO of a small company views their media somewhat differently than a large company CTO, that sort of thing. It can be a great exercise, not only for the end result, but for, I think, the process itself. Marketing teams that go through the process of creating personas tend to have a real vested interest in how they develop them. Tends to be a great team-building exercise. And, there's nothing like, the analogy would be a usability study, where there's nothing more educational than having someone sit down in front of your website who's never used it before and watching them move through it and realizing how very differently people view that content than you thought they would or than you do. And so using personas is a way of getting that objectivity in-house, which can be invaluable.
Mm-hmm. It also helps you, of course, with search engine marketing because you're figuring out what are the kinds of wording these people use to describe either the business problem that your technology solves or what committee they're on that is looking for this technology. For example, if you're an email service provider, do they say ESP? Do they say email broadcast firm? Do they say list house? Do they say email list sender? Do they say blast provider? I mean, think about all the different words different kinds of people might use just for that one technology. And it's probably not the word you're using yourself. It may not be the word you're advertising under.
That's absolutely true. Your keywords are a great place to help build those personas. Because that is the voice of the customer.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that you may want to build personas around are different types of prospects, such as a very price-conscious prospect versus a prospect who is extremely worried about customer service versus a prospect, you know, whose main concern is, they're already working with your competitor and they're disenchanted and are you really going to be better or not because now they're very, you know, are all vendors tarred with the same brush? That could be almost anybody who's bought CRM services maybe 5 years ago, and they all became very worried about whether it really was something that was going to work for them or not. How do you prove that, yes, our industry has evolved and we're incredible now, you should trust us again? There are all different worries and concerns that people bring to either your homepage or the landing page they're coming to, and you can't address them with one average sort of we're the leader in or, you know, general answer. You have to say, here's the ROI information for the price-conscious person. Here's the why we're trusted and our little award we just won, the reader review award for the disenchanted, trust-worried person. You have all these different things for these different people. Now, of course, turn to the next page and you'll see a couple of personas. Now, these are not complete personas. Personas usually go on for about 2 pages. They're not huge and gargantuan, but in my experience, they're usually 2 to 3 pages long. And often, yes, you do have a picture of a real person that you put in there. It may not actually be one of your customers. You're making up a faux person. So you don't want to use a real person. You want to use a fake person. But you can go to a place like istockphoto.com and, you know, pick up a picture that to you everyone can visualize, yeah, it's that person. It actually really helps with the visualization as you're copywriting to think about writing your copy just to that gal or that guy. I can't tell you how great a tool this is for creativity. It helps you change your voice. We actually included 13 different sample personas and industry profiles in the guide to get you started. So take a look at them. We're not saying these are the ones that are going to fit you, but they're definitely ones to get you started, get you thinking, well, how would read it through and then say, and then look at your website or look at your white paper and say, what would they think of this? Would they be interested? Would they not be interested? Would they be like, oh, my gosh, you know, would it alarm them? So use this as your major creative tool and your search engine marketing tool and even a tool for how to title your white papers because different personas will care about different words. It's just an amazing marketing tool. Of course, I think I'm almost a little too in love with them, but I really do find them so useful as a writer and as someone who is a creative person approaching the marketing process. And it is a somewhat scientific one because you really are basing everything on what the prospect cares about, on their pain points, and not on just the glory of your service and here are our product features. So it helps you turn the marketing around and make it so much more powerful. And to that end, I'd like to thank you for having come to our teleseminar, our annual teleseminar today. And if I was going to summarize what we talked about today, I would say it's the big three. It is you need to have fabulous content, content that may be built around personas or for personas, content that's written by someone who is truly passionate in your organization about your technology, about what it can do. They're probably not in the sales department. They may not be in the marketing department. They may not be in the management team. It's often someone in the tech team. You have to find that person, though. It could be all different job titles. There may be several of them. You also need to focus on evangelizing. You need to focus on getting your own customers to be wonderful word-of-mouth people, whether it's forwarding your email, whether it's forwarding your viral campaign, whether it's just telling their friends, yes, I trust this company. I know the others can't be trusted, but this is the trustworthy one. And we all know how important that is in certain categories. Next, you also need to focus on multiple touch points. As we've seen here, search is wonderful, but it is by no means the only influencer, and it is by no means the only influencer you should use. You've got to be out there at trade shows. You've got to be in email newsletters. You've got to be in search. You've got to be in magazines. You've got to get the PR going. It is, to me, I think the joy and the excitement of being a business-to-business marketer. You know, unlike mass consumer marketers who often find themselves slotted into these little niche jobs, you know, I am in charge of, you know, the radio campaigns to Hispanics in Miami. You know, business-to-business marketers are doing all media often, and they're doing campaigns of every possible type. I mean, you may be doing direct mail, you may be doing a podcast, you may suddenly be going off to the trade show. It's a very exciting career to be in. I'm thrilled to death by it, and I'm thrilled to have come from business to business. Anyway, if you have specific questions about today's presentation, please feel free to contact us at feedback@marketingsherpa.com. Yes, that is a real person who mans that email address. It is not a generic box that nobody looks at. We are in there constantly, and Stefan and his research team will answer any specific questions, no problem. If they can't find the answer, they will also let you know that, so they will get back to you. And if you'd just like to see the complete table of contents for all the charts and the personas and all the information in the larger business technology marketing benchmark guide, take a look. There's a hot link there on the very last page of our presentation. We have a complete table of charts, 151 charts and tables on that page. You can see, does it answer the questions you need answered? Take a look, and I urge you to take advantage of it. Thank you very much for your time today. Good afternoon.